Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us on Spirit Travels Radio. Tonight we have Wesley, who's going to come on and talk about his road to recovery. With that being said, we're going to bring him on now and introduce him and let him tell you a little bit about himself. Hi, Wesley.
Hi. It's an honor to be here tonight. You kind of got to excuse me. I've been getting ready for the holidays here. So I'm a single dad. I have an 11-year-old daughter, and I have one son that is he's of an age that lives in New York State. And so we've been kind of getting ready for Christmas. And, you know, and I want to tell you a little story about that. You know, I'm doing things today, you know, as I navigate through this healing journey called recovery. You know, I find myself doing things I would never do. Catch myself doing in my active addiction. So I'm kind of learning as I go along, you know, but it's really a healing part of my recovery to do these things, because, you know, for so many years, you know, I felt dead to the world. I felt dead inside, and, you know, it was really hard for me to get in touch with any emotions, and more or less in doing things like this, you know, like spending time with my daughter. And, you know, it's just been hard on a lot of us that's in recovery. It's been hard on a lot of people in recovery, you know, going through this pandemic. So it's real important for me to, you know, to make sure that my daughter that is taken care of emotionally and you know, I always worry about her mental health. And doing these things, I think it's just real important, and it helps me in my journey and in my healing. And I live here in Oklahoma. I'm from a town and about the middle of Oklahoma. It's Shawnee, Oklahoma, about 30,000 people. I'm a member of the Pawnee and Kickapoo tribes of Oklahoma. And my Indian name is Pepiasi. And, you know, I never understood what that meant. You know, it died with my grandfather. He named me that when I was at a very young age. And, you know, I used to joke around with people about it. I used to kind of think, you know, that, you know, well, maybe it means strong warrior, leader of men, you know. But I think today, more or less, maybe it means just more like pain in the rear or something. Because, you know, you know, as I went through my active addiction, I really uprooted a lot of relationships, and I rolled through people's lives, and that's what active addiction does. You know, it just takes everything from you, it drains you, and it drains the people around you, and it just sucks the life out of you. You know, and you know, my father was a very traditional Indian man. He died when I was 11 years old. But what I can remember is that. You know, he was very much into his culture, but, you know, he died of alcoholism, you know, and it seemed like I had two uncles on my father's side that died of alcoholism. And that's just kind of the way my life was, you know. I mean, and it was kind of normal for me living that way and living under with alcoholism in my life, you know. So, you know, I get into recovery, you know, I find that it was in the beginning was really abnormal for me, because the only life I knew was around active addiction. And so, you know, I always tell people that I'm not a self-made person. Everything that I have in my life today was given to me by a loving creator through other people. You know, I had no formal education when I started recovering. I dropped out of school when I was in about the ninth grade. I dropped out of school, and I just wasn't interested and I didn't have that male guidance that so many kids have growing up, and I didn't have none of that. You know, I kind of drifted off into other areas and trying to fit in and here. And I was also raised in boarding school. I went to Oklahoma has, at the time, it had probably about 8 or 9 active residential schools, and I and I ended up going to Carter Seminary and one Riverside Inn School here in Oklahoma. And so I kind of gravitated towards trying to fit in a lot. And, you know, I always felt so lost, you know. It would just, and I didn't realize a lot of this, you know, a lot of this I didn't realize it later on until after I got into recovery, because of how much that, how much and how far that, and how much addiction what it did to my life, and how separated I was from myself and my spirit. And so recovery, you know, going through recovery, a lot of it's new to me. Like, you know, like I was saying earlier about the holidays, I'm trying to navigate myself through this right now, and just I'm learning as I go. And it seems like every day is a new challenge, and every day, you know, in my life is definitely taken on a different meaning. And but I was always, I've been around recovery since I was 1985, and I have 3 years. My sobriety date is on February 17th, 2017. But before that, I was in recovery. I had 19 years in recovery. And I relapsed back in 2003. I relapsed, so I really feel today that I really want to work with people that who had relapsed. I kind of feel drawn to that because I know what it is to have recovery, and I know what it is to lose it. And especially with that amount of time, and today, you know, I know that time's important. I know that years are important. But what I look at today, I don't look at so much as time. I try to focus on a day at a time, because really, that's only any of us have is we have that, we just have just for today. And so I try to focus on that and try to take it a day at a time. But I never want to discount time itself, you know, someone that's in recovery. I just know that for me, I was humbled quite a bit. And but I got to recovery in 1985, and I come from an alcoholic background, and on my dad's side. On my mom's side, you know, there was no drinking or anything like that. So as a child growing up, there was a lot of clashes, and there was a lot of chaos in the family. There was both mental, physical, and spiritual abuse that was in the family, and it was always infighting. So, you know, I didn't know one day from another what was going to happen. You know, I mean, I always kind of walked around like, you know, the ball was going to drop or something, and I didn't know when that, you know, that's, I always expected something. To go wrong, or something bad to happen, and the thing about that is, I carried that around for a lot of years. I carried that on into my adulthood, and I carried it on. And after I got sober, something I had to start dealing with, and something I still deal with now. But you know, it was, you know, during the holidays, you know, it was either off, or we was either off, or we was on, and you know, I could remember there was some drag out fights. When I was a kid, I remember that my mom would be so angry with my dad, you know, because of his drinking, that a lot of times, you know, we would either have a holiday dinner or we wouldn't. A lot of times it was thrown on the floor. A lot of times there was a lot of physical abuse involved, verbal abuse, and I got four other siblings, and I'm the youngest. And so that's what my childhood was like growing up. I didn't know from one day to the next what it was going to be like. And it was very much a hard time growing up in those situations. So my mom had a lot of anger towards my dad because of his drinking. And a lot of times I was forced to go with my dad at a young age because she wanted him to take on some responsibility that he was in no way capable or of doing a lot of times. A lot of times I would wake up, and I'd wake up in the back seat of a car, and sometimes I'd wake up at someone's house, and he'd be, you know, inside the house, and I'd wake up in the back seat, and sometimes I'd wake up on the side of the road, some back country road, and he'd be passed out, and I couldn't wake him up. Or there would be times that I'd wake up at a bar, and I could remember that time I'd wake up, he'd be tapping on the window, and he'd bring me out like a soda, and he'd bring me out with a bag of chips, and that was a lot of my childhood growing up. It was pretty. I didn't know how traumatizing it was until I got older, and it's so many issues that I had to address, and. But I can remember going to powwows at a young age and going camping, and a lot of those, you know, were turned into total chaos. Once again, you know, it was just kind of the norm in my family. And as I got older, I've come to find out it was pretty much normal for the Native communities and the other Native families that grew up in that type of environment, and kind of that historical trauma that we carried around. That drinking brings on, and I never understood it, and maybe I wasn't supposed to at a young age, but as I got older, I kind of found myself walking in the same footsteps as my father. He was, I always was trying to guess what normal was because I had absolutely no idea what normal was supposed to be like, and. So I did a lot of guessing, you know, and I had a lot of dreams and aspirations as a lot of young kids have, a lot of teenagers have, but I just never could seem to follow through with them. And feelings of low self-worth began to take over my life. And so I kind of gravitated towards other people that were just like me, other kids. And I got into inhalants at a young age and kind of graduated to drinking in my early 20s. I always hung around with people who were probably old enough to be my dad or twice as old as I was, and I could remember them telling me, you know, because I was into inhalants pretty bad at the time, you know, I got to huffing spray paint, but I can remember. Them telling me, you know, you need to get off that stuff. That stuff is, you know, it's going to ruin your brain, and you ain't going to have any brain cells left. And if you want to hang out with us, you got to drink this. And they handed me a bottle of wine, and so all I did was switch addictions. But I kind of graduated into drinking real heavy. Probably from that age of 19, I got off the inhalants, and I started to drink. Alcoholically at a young age, and at that time I started to experience blackouts. I never knew where I would end up at, you know, when people would tell me things that I did, and I had absolutely no idea what I did the night before, and I'd wake up in back seats of the cars. Houses, you know, and I had some other friends, other acquaintances, you know, and I'd hear stories about them doing things, and like me, I'd sometimes wake up and I got pretty well known with the Shawnee, the policeman department here, and they got to know me by name, and so they got to stopping me every time that they seen me. Drunk or sober, and most of the time I was intoxicated, and so I guess I made a good trustee or something because I was in, you know, sometimes two or three times a week I was in jail. Sometimes I was right back in jail after I got out of jail within a few hours. I was right back in a jail and back in a drunk tank again. But I had some friends that were kind of like me that would wake up, you know. I wouldn't remember from a blackout, and a couple of them woke up that that had committed crimes that landed in the penal system. And one of my friends that ended up in the penal system, he had beat a guy to death and had been in a blackout, and he didn't even realize that he had done that. And you know, that could, the thing about it is, I thought at the time, I thought that was pretty bad, and I had this fear of doing something like that, but that didn't stop me. I mean, the way I dealt with my fears is I kept drinking, and I always tell people that, I don't know if you ever drunk yourself sober, but it got to the point in my alcoholism and my addiction that I got to the point where in the beginning, it was a coping mechanism, and it got to the point that it just wasn't working anymore. No matter how much I drank, it just wasn't working anymore. I didn't have the same effect that it did when I was, when I first started out. I just couldn't recapture that one perfect high or perfect drunk. And I kept drinking more and more, but and all I was doing was just beginning to black out, and I didn't know what it was to finish anything. I mean, I dropped out of school. I was incorrigible. I couldn't get along with people. I was very angry, and I didn't understand all that. I didn't attach myself to anything or people. I became very non-trusting, and I just didn't know what it was, but it's the only life I knew. I mean, that's the only way I knew how to live. And everyone that I associated with was just like me. That's the only ones I related to. And so I began to black out more and more. And I could remember one time, on Sundays here in Oklahoma, at the time, the liquor stores, there was no liquor stores open, so we had to go to the bootleggers to get something to drink. And I can remember... I took the car keys off of a friend of mine, and I drove his little Pinto, a little Indian car Pinto, and I took the drive, and then my cousin went with me, and I can remember going to the bootleggers, and I was going over this bridge, and it was an old bridge, and I remember all it took was a few seconds, and I blacked out, and the next thing I know, I knew we were upside down in the river. And I don't even remember how we went. I don't know if the water maybe come through, but I remember swimming out of the car but the only window that was rolled down was the passenger side, and that's the side that my cousin was on, and I guess I swam right past her or something, but I came up, and I was in a total panic. I couldn't believe. I didn't even remember what happened, how we got down there, and there was some. It's kind of crazy because I had some friends that were fishing underneath that bridge, and they knew who I was, and they said, someone else is still in the car, and I was really in a panic mode at the time, and about that time, my cousin, she surfaced. And I think it's only by grace today that she came up, because I could have killed both of us. I could have drowned both of us. So from that point on, I was just in a state of, it was like having PTSD. I guess I'm a recovering. I have PTSD too. I'm dealing with that, and I'll get more into that as I go along. But I remember telling on that bank, I made it to the bank. I made her, gave her a helping hand up there. And I can remember telling myself, I said, this is it. No more quitting drinking. This is it. And it really felt like, and I really meant that. It really felt like it was a hard bottom for me at the time when that happened. And I could remember, I made it back to the house, and we got back to the house, and as I made it back to the house, there were several patrol cars that showed up, and I ended up going to the county jail over that, and I ended up spending about three months in the county jail because of that situation. And that whole time I was in there, I was thinking, this is it. I'm going to quit. This is it. And the day I got out, I wasn't eating out a full day. I was back to doing the same thing I did before. I was back to drinking again. And that's the insanity of the first drink or that first pill or first fix or whatever you want to call it. That's the insanity of it. You know, I always had a lot of good intentions, and I really meant them, but I just couldn't stop. And I went through a lot of years like that, situations like that, and I kept progressing more downhill. And I always tell people that, you know, I never was this one, this high roller that I tried to portray. I was one of these low bottom drunks or addicts, drug addicts, and I was one of those addicts that, you know, whatever I could scuffle up that day, that's what I had. And sometimes I had big habits. Sometimes I had very small habits. It's just whatever I could scrape up that day. And but I kept progressing downhill, and my binges began to get longer and longer. My blackouts began to increase. Not knowing what I did, I was doing stupid things in front of people that I wouldn't even remember. I was getting teased a lot for it. And I look back on that now, you know, it's just, I'm just grateful that I didn't kill someone or kill myself. And I was in jail quite a bit. I was, I didn't know what it was like to live a productive life, a productive sober life. I was living the only life that I knew at the time. And I could remember my mother would tell me, she made her journey about 6 years ago, but I put that woman through hell and back. And before she died, I remember I was able to tell her goodbye, and I don't know, you know, and I was able to tell her, you know, I'm gonna make a difference. And And I'll get a little bit more into that a little bit later on. But I, you know, I put that woman through a lot. And she would tell me she was always so glad when I got thrown in jail because she always knew that I was alive. And I got a son today that I know how she feels, but I got a son today that is dealing with his own active addiction. And he's got about a little over a week now sober, and I'm so grateful for that. Because, but I know how it is, you know. I know how it is. I'm not trying to tell his story, but I know how it is to when a parent when he's been in and out of prison since he was 18 years old, and I always was glad when he was in prison. At least I knew he was alive, you know. And no matter, you know, and even though how hard, you know, must have been really hard on him being in there, but I knew he was alive, and I was always praying that, you know, that he would hit a bottom and that he would find recovery for himself, like I found it in recovery. But anyway, I went through a lot of years like that, you know, just progressing further and further downhill. And I met this guy that I drank with, and we sold dope together, and we drink wine together, or whatever we could scrape up, and I can remember, I remember back this guy helped me end up, he helped me get into recovery, but I was on about a week's binge drinking, and at that time I must have had a few bologna sandwiches, you know, most of it was drinking. But prior to that, I had tried to quit drinking before. You know, I went to treatment. I went to halfway houses. There was a center called the Indian Action Center here in Shawnee that catered towards Native American men. And they had a halfway house there, and I found myself going into this place, but that kind of started a pattern of me going in and out of treatment, and so But I was in treatment so much, and I was, and at times as I look back, I use these places just for a place to stay. And it was a lot of information, but it never, none of it really sunk in because I wasn't ready. But I was counting one day, you know, I was in and out of treatment 8 different times, not including halfway houses and jails, and you know, I just never stayed sober. And it got to where these places would turn me down because they knew who I was, you know. And the last treatment center that I was in, I could remember saying, you know, we're going to help you, but if we feel like you're not making an effort, then we're going to discharge you. And I didn't even last the night. I knew I wasn't going to make it, so I left. And but this guy that I drank with, I was on about a week binge, and but prior to that, you know, I had went to an AA meeting, and he was in there, and he used to have really long hair, and he had a really long, these goateed beards and really long beards, and kind of looked like Grizzly Adams, you know. But I went to this AA meeting, and I was wondering, and I heard someone say, "Hey Wes, how you doing?" And I, you know, it was him, but I, but it wasn't him because I couldn't recognize him. But he had cut his hair, and his beard was all trimmed and shaved, I didn't recognize him. But he told me his name, and his name was Fred, and I said, "Fred." And yeah, you know, he was glad to see me, and you know, I wondered in this AA meeting, and I don't know if I can't even remember if I stayed a whole hour or not. They used to last an hour at the time, but I remember I after I left the meeting, I went drinking again, and I guess a few months later, I was on this bench for about a week, and I just got to where my body was so toxic, I couldn't take it anymore. My body just couldn't handle it anymore, and. I remember where he lived, and I remember that him being in this Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. So I ended up in his meeting. I ended up at his door, and I said, "Are you still going to those meetings?" He goes, "Yeah." I said, "Man, can you help me?" I said, "I'm really sick and I need help." And he goes, "Yeah, come on in," you know. And so I don't know what, I can't even remember all that was said. I just kind of remember what happened. He had given me a ride, and he took me back to my mother's house at the time. And the thing that stuck out that I do remember is him telling my mother, you know, "I can't get this guy sober, but what I can do is I can pick him up every day. I can take him to a meeting." And, you know, and that's what happened, you know. I mean, I guess I probably should have been in a detox center at the time, and I should have probably even been in treatment facility. But something inside of me clicked, and something inside of me had to know if I wanted this thing or not. And there was a lot of rough nights. You know, I would sleep during the day, and I would stay up half the night, and, you know, I just couldn't sleep. I couldn't sleep at all, really. You know, you know, I don't even call it sleep, but I'd wake up and I'd hear someone call my name saying, you know, "Wes," and I'd say, "What?" And there was no one around, you know. I was hearing things, and, you know, my chest was hurting, and I was really nervous, and it just felt like my chest was going to pop out of my heart was going to pop out of my chest, and I was real nervous, and I probably was really heart attack prone at the time, but somehow by the grace of a loving creator, I made it through that. And I remember he would knock on the door. He'd call me every morning, knock on the door. And at the time there was noon meetings, there was evening meetings, and there was night meetings. There was 3 meetings a day, and he'd pick me up every day and take me to a meeting. Every single day he would take me to a meeting. And off we go. And you know, and I remember being dragged to a treatment center. You know, we carried what they call a bridge to gap meetings. Alcoholics Anonymous calls them bridge to gap, where they would carry meetings into the other facilities and treatment centers. And I remember saying, you know, we're going to carry the message to this treatment center, and you're going with us. Okay. You know, so I went and I don't even think I had 30 days at the time. sober, but I remember, I think I was just going to, I thought I was just going to go down, you know, for the ride. I didn't know I was going to have to get up in front of everybody, you know, and, but they pulled me up in front, and I remember saying to them, you know, by all rights, I should be out there sitting with you guys. And, you know, and that was the truth, you know. I mean, they were, you know, they were in the same spot I was, you know, so many different times in treatment, you know. And but as I continued to go to meetings, you know, I began to stay sober, you know. And the only time I can get any time I can get sober if I was locked up or if I was institutionalized or somewhere. But that was the first time in a long time that I could remember that I was, you know, maybe since I was a young kid, that I was actually sober on my own for 30 days. I made 30 days. And I remember getting these chips, and I kept going to meetings. And then I find myself, you know, 30 days turned into 2 months, 2 months turned into 6 months, and then 6 months turned into 1 year. And it was like that. You know, I was actually a part of recovery. For the first time in my life, I was doing things I never thought was that I could possibly do, and that was have recovery and stay sober. And I say that I'm not a self-made person. I am, because I didn't know what it was like. I didn't know what it was like to have a job. I didn't know what it was to be responsible, and it was scared the heck out of me to even think about being responsible. But I got to looking around our rooms, and I seen a lot of the members. They had was leading productive lives. They had jobs, but they had also had sponsors that was working with them. And I guess about the first year, I didn't have a sponsor, and I got to looking around the room, and then this one guy that I admired a lot, he seemed to, you know, have his life together pretty well, and he was very soft-spoken. He's a very compassionate person, and he seemed to have all these women hanging around him, which I liked, you know. And, you know, and so, you know, I kind of latched on to him. And I got the courage to ask him to be my sponsor. And I was about a year sober, and I remember – he goes, okay, let me think about it here for a minute. And so we made a date, and I can remember he handed me a piece of paper. And he goes, I want you to read this, and after you read it, I want you to call me back. And so I read it. He goes, Wes, this is what I do for my recovery. If you don't want to do these things, I'll still be your friend, but I'll just continue sponsoring you. And he gave me this list of things. What he wanted me to do, and one of the first things he had me do, he wanted me to do, and one before I did anything else, is to get on my knees and ask God, the Creator, to help me to stay sober that day. And I'm telling you, the two things that really stuck out with me, and the last one was on the list, you know. He goes, I want you to, well, in between that, but I want you to go to meetings. I expect you at meetings. I want you to make certain meetings. I want you to reach out to other people. And the last sentence, he goes, I want you to find a job. I don't care what it is. I don't care if it's washing dishes. I don't care if it's paper out. But on the very last of it, on the list, it says, and I want you to move out of your mom's house. And that scared the crap out of me, because I didn't know what it was to be self-supporting. I mean, the job scared me too, because I didn't know what it was to be self-supporting. I didn't know what it was to hold a job down. I never really had a full-time job. I always had these part-time jobs, these spot jobs that I got, and I'd work for a few hours, and I'd get paid this the same day, and I always used that money to get that money always went towards my active addiction, my drinking or my using or whatever I did. He goes, I want you to find a job. I don't care what it is. And I want you to move out of your mom's house. And it scared the tar out of me. But he seen that, you know, I was 25 years old at the time. And he seen that, you know, I was really latched on to my mother. And my mother always took care of me. You know, she bailed me out of jail. Mm-hmm. She gave me a place to stay. She fed me, and as much as much as hell that I put her through with my drinking and using, she always came through for me. And he seen that was very much of an unhealthy dependency that I had on her. And he knew if I was going to grow, and I didn't see that at the time. I see it now. If I was going to grow, any, I had to become self-supporting. So I end up getting a dishwashing job, and I remember, and it kind of progressed from there. And later on, I was able to get. I remember my first place. It was a roach-infested place. it was an efficiency apartment in Norman, Oklahoma, and there was roaches on the wall. But it was my place. You know, I remember sleeping on the floor. You know, there was an old mattress on the floor. That was my bed. You know, and I had this old TV at the time, this rabbit ear TV. And I remember having that TV. And it's a far cry from where I'm at today. But it was mine, you know. I remember having a job that I went to at this cafeteria, and you know, I was bussing tables, washing dishes, and I began to hold a job down, and it was a very, after at the time it felt like a very humiliating experience, but at the same time it was a very, you know, look back, was very humble. It was exactly what I needed at the time. And you know, mm-hmm. I say, when a student's ready, the teacher always appears. And that was my teacher. He ended up being my sponsor for the probably 20 years. He was my sponsor. He passed away in 2012, but he ended up being my sponsor that whole time. I ended up holding that job down. And I remember I kind of progressed from there, and I was still going to meetings, and he took me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous. He took me through the steps, and he taught me a lot of things. And he'd always write me. He was a writer. He ended up becoming a journalism. He went back to school. He was an electrician, but he wanted to become a journalist. So he ended up going to journalism for the University of Oklahoma and became a journalist. But he was always writing me these notes. He said, "Wes, remember to love yourself. Do you love yourself?" And because he knew that I didn't have a very good high opinion of myself, and I had very low self-worth. Even after I got sober, I was dealing with this thing, because I always compared myself to what other people were doing. I compared my insides by other people's outsides, and I determined at that time whether I was doing okay or not. And the trouble with when I do that is that, you know, I always come out on the short end of the stick, and the reality of it is whether I'm not, you know, I'm who I am, and God has taken care of me. And once again, you know, everything's 2020 for me. I look back and I was going through all these progressions and recovery. I end up from that dishwashing job. Doing prep work. I graduated from the dish pit to the prep table. And from the prep table, I graduated to the line cook. From the line cook, I progressed to head trainer. From head trainer, I progressed to be a director of a long-term assistant living director. And then I was making salaries, and that's the progression. That's where recovery had took me. You know, I was actually doing things I never thought I could do. You know, I mean, I was doing things that, you know, way beyond my educational level. I was doing things that I never thought I could do or even dream of doing. And when I look back, you know, I had all these teachers. That's why I say I'm not a self-made person. Everything that I have today has been given to me through other people, by the grace of a loving God, and working through other people and being taught. I had to be taught, you know, how to live again, how to function, how to be a productive member of society, and I was doing all these things, you know, and I progressed to having a better place. I progressed from having a roach infested apartment with these cockroaches crawling up the wall to having a three bedroom townhome, driving a pretty nice car, and I had this 04. I remember my first vehicle. I didn't even have a driver's license, you know, and I got it with my first income tax check, and I got about $1,500 and back from my income tax, and I bought this old Ford car. And I didn't even have a driver's license, so I couldn't drive it. But I was driving it anyway, and you know, no license. I got pulled over, and supposedly I'm sober. I was doing all these things that you're not supposed to do in recovery, but I got pulled over and got my license suspended, which I didn't have. And so later on, when I did end up getting my license, it cost me. I had to pay all these back fines and had to get legal. I ended up getting legal and getting a driver's license and insurance and stuff like that. That it's getting out of that lifestyle. You know, even though I was sober, I was still doing all these things that I did when I was drinking. The only thing I wasn't doing was drinking, but I was still living that negative lifestyle. But I ended up getting my driver's license. And that was a big deal for me because I never had a driver's license. I was 30 years old. I had 5 years into recovery, and I never had a driver's license. And so I got a driver's license, and I was driving this old Ford around, and the thing kept breaking down on me, but it took me from A to B. It took me to meetings, and it took me to work, and when it wasn't running, I'd either walk or I'd ride a bike to work, and ride a 10-speed to work. But I progressed from that old Ford to to having a better car, and it kept progressing, and I was making more money than I ever had. I was going places and doing things, and so I thought I had arrived, you know, and I thought, oh, this is it, you know. I mean, had my own place, and had a better car, had a nice place, and you know, somewhere along the way, I began to get caught up in all that, and I always tell people that, you know, I don't know what Creator's will for us is sometimes, but sometimes we have to go through what we need to go through, and I kind of forgot where I came from. And I tell people, I said, sometimes I think I didn't know how to handle success, you know, at the time, you know, and I forgot where I came from. And I got to learning about catering. So I'd go on these catering events, and I would work long hours. I'd work, sometimes I'd work 13, 12, 17 hours shifts. I was working for a 3-star restaurant, and during the holiday season, we would, it was our peak season. That's where we made our money. So I'd get there at 4. It wasn't a call for me to get there at 4 o'clock in the morning and get off midnight. So working on, but I was making all this, this is where I made my money. I was making all this money, and I had checks coming in. And, and I lived in a college town. Norman, Oklahoma is where the University of Oklahoma is. So there's a lot of college students working in the restaurant. And after work, everybody would going out, and I would say, we're going out for drinks. Do you want to come? I said, no, I'm going to go home. At the time, I got caught. It's more about work, and things began to slide. I wasn't going to as many meetings, and I was going to one or two meetings a week, and then I was going to one meeting, and it got to the point I wasn't going to any meetings. And one night, someone asked me, "Do you want to go out?" Yeah. Well, why not? Yeah. I said, "I'm it's a long day." So we went to this club, and it felt very awkward because, you know, at the time I had about 10 years at the time. And I will tell you, I didn't drink. I didn't drink at that time. I didn't drink. I ended up drinking a Coke. Someone offered me a drink, and I kind of decided, well, that's not for me. You know, I need to get back on a bandwagon. I started to go back to meetings. And a few years later, around 2003, I kind of went through the same thing again. You know, I had all these visual signs of success, doing well, had some years under my belt. I was doing service work in 12-step programs. I was chairman of conference committees. We were putting on conferences and with the state of Oklahoma and campouts, mm-hmm. conferences. I was on service boards committees, and once again, I got caught up in other things, you know, and I identify more as when I say that I'm an addict, because I'm addicted to anything that makes me feel good. I mean, I switched addictions so much, and I got off alcoholism, other things took over, and I've had to deal with gambling, I've had to deal with relationships, and a lot of other things, and I had to deal with. Also, had to go back and deal with getting to counseling and deal with PTSD. But in 2003, I got into this relationship, and I don't think it was in my best interest. But I stopped going to meetings, stopped doing the things that pertain to my healing and recovery. And I started going places that I shouldn't have been in. I started going to these the adult entertainment industry clubs. Start hanging out in these nightclubs, and I started going to casinos. And I remember my sponsor would tell me he would tell me there's spiritually sick people in there, and you need to stay out of there. But I started going to these places, and I just start hanging around a totally different crowd of people, mm-hmm. and I lost contact with the recovery community, and I lost contact with my sponsor. And one night I was in a strip club, and I went to a strip club which I shouldn't have been in, and I just ordered a beer. And it's amazing. I just blocked everything out, and I took the beer and I downed it. And that was in 2003. And it set off a chain of events. You know, first few times I thought, well, I can control it. And what I did is, I guess I became a functional drunk. And I began to hang out in casinos more. But in the 14-year period, I started a 14-year relapse. Everything, it was different this time around, because it was a little bit different. My bottom was a little bit different. I always told myself, when I'm not getting back on the hard liquor, I was proud of myself on just drinking beer, because I thought myself I could control the beer because I know my surroundings. But if I get on the liquor, the hard liquor, the vodka or the wine, then I start blacking out. So I became a beer drinker, and I thought, I was controlling it. But, I got to hanging around these casinos, buying this dollar beer that they would serve, and I started gambling, and I found myself spending my whole paychecks up, I was caught up in that cycle of addiction again. And I was doing the things. I was end up taking money from my mother, borrowing money, getting into payday loans that I couldn't pay back, losing everything that I had, pawning everything that I had. And the only way I could maintain this lifestyle, if I was drinking. And it got to the point that it wasn't even working no more. And it was just a 14-year bottom that I wrote out. And I remember going to grocery stores. I'd go into grocery stores, and if I see someone in recovery, I'd shoot my grocery cart the other way, because I was ashamed to be seen. And the thing about it, people know what you're doing. They know what you're doing, because they don't see you around, and they have a pretty good idea what you're doing. Because I tell you right now, you can't fool another alcoholic. You can't fool another addict, because they know. They know it when they see it. And so I end up coming back, and once again, I end up coming back, and I hit another bottom. In 2017, I called an old friend of mine. It was a female friend of mine that I knew in a meeting that we recovered together. And she said, well, there's a meeting tonight if you want to come. And I remember I said, yeah, I'll meet you down there. And I really wanted to go, but I was scared, you know. I had all this vision in my mind, you know, people were going to be shaking their, where you been, you know, we told you, you know, and then there were, you know, this was, you know, it's just amazing, you know, how your head gets away from you. You make up all these scenarios in your head, but it wasn't like that at all. They gave me a hug, and they were glad to see me. I seen other people I knew, and two people that I knew that was in recovery sat on each side of me, and they were glad to see me. And so I've been sober since then. You know, 2003. This is I've been sober almost 4. It'll be in February. It'll be 4 years. February 17th. I'll have 4 years again. And I tell you what, you know, people. Oh, thank you, thank you. People always ask me and said, you know, would you change that? And to be honest, I said yes, yes, and no, because you know, I'm using a lot of that today to help other people. I kind of graduated, you know, as I got more and more into the, you know, I'm into going to the meetings, you know, something was always missing and felt like it was missing in my life. And I met some other Native friends that were into the Wellbriety, White Bison Wellbriety movement. And I was always, you know, I've been around culture all my life. My dad would take us to powwows. Like I said in the beginning, he was a very spiritual man. I believe he was spiritual, but at the same time, his alcoholism killed him. But I was introduced to the Wellbriety program, the Wellbriety movement. I remember going into a Wellbriety meeting. At one time I was living in Oregon, I remember going into a Wellbriety meeting, and that was my first introduction to Wellbriety. And then about 4 years ago, I have a friend that he's a substance abuse counselor for the Absentee Shawnee Tribe here in Shawnee, and he told me about a meeting that he was starting, and that was my really first introduction to Wellbriety, White Bison, and so I moved more into the I just felt like, you know, it just felt like a homecoming. It felt like it filled in the missing pieces. And it introduced me back to the culture. When I was around it, I never was really. I always felt like I was never really a part of it. I was there, always there for the wrong reason. I was always in the background drinking or something. So I began. I ended up going to Wellbriety, and I began to get reintroduced to the culture. I got reintroduced to going to sweats, and I begin to learn about the culture again. And that's the thing about when I talk about a lot of us natives, you know, especially here in Oklahoma, there's 39 federally recognized tribes here in the state of Oklahoma, and there's three that aren't. Well, there's 37 recognized tribes. There's 39 tribes here, but there's 37 that are recognized. So we get a lot of diversity for our tribes are here, and so a lot of us, you know, we kind of lost track of our culture, and a lot of it's been maintained, and a lot of it's been lost, and a lot of this new generation come up. But I started learning about the Wellbriety movement, and I wanted to start learning about my culture again. So I was, you know, started going to sweats, started going to the Book of Wellbriety, started learning about the steps. But you know how we apply these steps to our Native American tradition, and it just felt good. And I started going to Native American conferences. It's just amazing when you're about recovery. You know you're about recovery. And I remember when this last time around, I got on my knees and I said, you know, I said, God, if you help me, I'll do whatever you want me to do. I'll give back. And that was kind of my promise to him. So that's what I've been doing, you know, and it seems like when you're about that, Creator always provides a way. That's what I tell people. If you want help, and you're sincere about it, then Creator will provide a way for you. And so, and I've had, you know, I've had more money when I was drinking. When I said, man, I made more money back then, and I got very little money now. And but I see all my needs are met. It's just totally different, you know, way Creator provides.
Yeah.
And I've been able to go travel and do things I never thought I would be able to do. And it's always been a way provided. I never had a way to go, but some way was always provided for me. And I've been to Florida. I've been, you know, I've been to conferences here in Oklahoma. I've been able to go to the Seminoles of Florida to their conference. I travel back and forth to Minnesota. I'm a member of a sobriety group too called Sober Squad that originated out of Minnesota. I got a chapter here in a Sober Squad here in Oklahoma. There's one in Arizona, and I became a member there. I don't know how I got here. I don't know how. It's just totally different. That's why I say I never know where my talks are going to take me, because things change all the time, you know. And sometimes I don't know what Creator what wants from me. You know, I just go where He wants me to go, you know. And sometimes I don't understand, you know. I don't understand. You know? I just go with the flow. And I feel drawn towards my native. I mean, don't get me wrong, I would help anybody, but I feel drawn towards my native people. Because I see what it done. I've seen what the devastation of addiction and alcoholism has done to our people. And so my heart, that's where my heart is. And that's where I feel like I'm being led. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like I'm being led today. About a week ago, I went to training for White Bison, fire starter training. I went through that. And I graduated, and I was able to go through that. So now I am now a fire starter. So my hope is to get some groups going around here again. It's been really difficult during this pandemic. It's so much is going on right now. But I'm also a member of Sober Indians, and Patrick asked me if I wanted to come on and speak. And I've met all these people from all these other natives, and it does my heart so good to see that, you know. Yes, there's a lot of hurt, and there's a lot of things that's happened to us, but on the flip side, you know, there's a lot of things that's happening. I believe we're in a time of healing. You know, there's now thousands of us that are sober, and you can Sober Indians attest to that. There's over 70,000 members. There's Sober Squad, and there's sobriety powwows that I go to and out of state and in here and conferences. We go to sweats and we're all sober and we're all a part of that circle. And it feels good to be home. It's a homecoming for me, because a lot of us has been lost for a lot of years. We lost our way. We lost our language. We lost our culture. But I believe that stuff can come back. It's coming back to us. We're being taught to get, and the elders foretold this, and so, like I said, I hope someone got something out of this. You know, I really don't look for pats on the back. I'm just doing what I feel like, the promise I made, and what I feel like the Creator wants me to do. And like I said, nothing I have today is of my own making. I'm not a self-made person. I'm only giving back and trying to give back what was given to me, so freely given to me. And if it wasn't for guys and females that are in recovery, I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here this time around. But I hope you got something out of this, and I look forward to meeting you guys. And as I navigate my way through this thing called recovery, this healing journey that I'm on, And I appreciate you having me. It's been an honor. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thank you for coming on, and thank you for sharing. I take from every show that I do with you guys when you come on and talk, and I appreciate mm-hmm. that. And I know there's somebody out there listening that has gotten something from this tonight. And thank mm-hmm. you. very, very much for coming on and sharing your story with us.
Oh, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Have a great evening.
You too.
Thank you. Well, that was Wesley, and that was an amazing story that we just listened to. And I hope everybody really thought very hard about what he was saying tonight. And we also have, now we have Gene that's going to be coming on. Are you with us now, Gene? Okay.
Yeah, I am.
Hello, and thank you for coming in.
Can you hear me okay?
We'll start, I can hear you perfectly well. I wanted to start by having you tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, I'm 70 years old. I'm non-Native, but I've been associated with a number of Natives for most of my life. I come out of Kansas, and I live Four Corners area of Colorado, not too far from Mesa Verde. Matter of fact, I can see Mesa Verde out in my backyard. Are you hearing me okay?
I can hear you, yes.
Okay. I began drinking early teens, and that continued up until I was in my 30s, 1988. I was married one time, had three boys, and that fell apart, partially because of the drinking. I ended up single for a few years. I got in a really toxic relationship, and that ended, and I went back to drinking, which I'd still been drinking during that time. And then I met my wife. I'd known her for a couple of years, my second wife. And thanks to her and the Creator, I've been blessed to be sober for 32 years. I belong to a group called Southwest Intertribal Voice here in Cortez, Colorado. We're a nonprofit Native American group, World of All Tribes. We're currently slowly but surely building a ceremonial ground in the culture preservation area about 5 miles south of Cortez. And that's ran by Arthur Nesguy. His dad owned that place at one time. When he walked on, he left that place to the group. I was a really hardcore drinker, but I was very, it was very productive. I didn't miss work because of being hungover, being intoxicated. My poison of choice was Old Granddad or Wild Turkey and Budweiser. Now it's iced tea and Pepsi. I've been with Sober Indians for a few years now, and I'm one of the Peacekeepers. And it's just a great group, a super, super great group. There's a lot of strength there. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people that care. Just really an honor to be involved with Patrick and this group. And really excited to see these blogs going on. I think that's a huge, huge benefit. Of course, we have a lot of alcohol problems out here. We're not too far from the Ute Mountain Reservation and also the Navajo Nation. That's the two tribes that I mostly associated with. We have an awful lot of alcoholism, unfortunately, and we don't have a lot of, well, like Cortez is close to 10,000 people. We don't have a detox, and we're trying currently to figure out that funding to get a detox. We also don't have any aftercare for people that come back from treatment, and that's where Southwest comes in. We've got a 24-foot hogan, a log hogan down on the property, and also a 24-foot can be used on-premise. We do it by donation. I don't think we've ever – I know we've never turned away a First Nations family that needs that property for ceremony. We've done NAC meetings down there. We've done education meetings for the kids. We've done weddings, just whatever our Native communities need. That property is available. So, I'm kind of breaking up, I think. Can you hear me? I can hear you guys, but you're breaking up.
I can hear you.
Okay. Okay. He held almost 24 acres south of town, Southwestern Tribal does. And that's kind of, I've been there for 17, 18 years on the board. It's a great group, too, but it's really, really small. It took 2 years to build our Hogan because we had volunteers work maybe one day a week. But it came out really nice. I also belong to a few groups in the area, a group called Communities That Care. That's an outreach to youth. I also belong to a group that deals with preventing suicides by youth in our area. And let's see, there's four or five other groups that we're affiliated with, Lions Club and that type of thing. I'm looking forward to retiring one of these days and do nothing but this. We're not too far from, we're only about 52 miles from Shiprock, New Mexico. Our area has been hit really hard with the pandemic. We've lost over 650 people just on the Navajo Nation because of the COVID. They're in total lockdown on the weekends. Really, again, I just really am honored to be a part of this group. It amazes me on how many people are coming on board and the good that's being done by this bunch. It's just incredible. You're back east, correct?
I am. I'm in Kentucky.
Oh, Kentucky. Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's kind of an interesting area. A lot different than what we are out
it
here
is.
In the high desert. But one of the problems that we deal with out here a lot is we have 30% of the homes on the Navajo Nation do not have running water. Talking about an area that's, if it were a state rather than a reserve, would be about 2,000 miles, would be 10th largest state in the Union, and it's about 2,000 square miles larger than the state of West Virginia. So it's in three states, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah. And then Ute Mountain, just south of us, they have that's a band of the Ute Nation. Their reservation is 597,000 square acres, but it's just drafted by the Navajo. It is such a big area. We can use all the help we can get out here.
Well, hopefully, hopefully this show is going to help do that, because I think it's needed. I agree.
Yeah, if we can just get more people educated in, I'm sure most of the audience knows that, for instance, Native women are up to 10 times more likely to be the victims of a homicide than any other race. And that's totally unacceptable. I mean, we've got to put a stop to this, the drinking. It seems like alcohol and other drugs are involved in a lot of the violence that we see out here.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Navajo Nation is dry, and as is the Ute Nation also is dry. We have bootleggers coming up. We're off reservation. We're just north of Cortez. We have a lot of bootleggers coming up buying alcohol, taking it back, tripling, quadrupling prices on the reserve. And it's a really, I don't know whether you call it the cottage industry or what, but that's one of the things we see also. We do have a homeless shelter open during the wintertime, finally. And we still lose one, maybe two people average in the parks during winter to exposure. And we get really cold out here, and especially if they have been drinking, they will lay down on the ground and we have a fatality. Trying to think where else to go with this. The major reason when I quit drinking, as I said, I met my second wife, and that was 32 years ago in September. And thanks to her, I realized there was a whole lot more to life than the alcohol. And there were some really rough times, but the cravings were really strong sometimes. But with her help and the Creator's help, we got through it. I'm so thankful that she stood by me through a whole lot of things. And I don't think I could have made it without her. Matter of fact, I know I couldn't have. And we have two sons of our own. And we've got, I had three sons from my first marriage. She had two. Plus, we adopted a kid down in New Mexico. So we got eight boys and a daughter. So I think we have, I believe, 18 grandchildren and two great-grandchildren.
Well, congratulations.
Oh, it's fun. We've never had them all together at one time. One of these days, hopefully. They're scattered from here in Farmington to Grand Junction, Colorado, about 200 miles north, all the way to Salt Lake and also Washington State. So maybe one of these days we can get them all in the same location, at least the same zip code.
Well, what has Sober Indians done for you as far as the support in this group?
Now, the question was, what has Sober Indians done for me, the group?
Mm-hmm. So with the support for
moral support, the desire, I think, shared by all people to be a part of something bigger than yourself, more important than yourself, is all those things. They have been there. I can get online anytime. Somebody's online. The ability to give back what I have been given, which is sobriety and a family and a life, to help people get that. That's a great blessing for me. I think it is for all of us. I think that's why we're here. We have a leadership that is phenomenal. Nothing but respect for our leaders and our other members. I mean, this is a group that just blows my mind every time I look at our numbers. Or I see somebody crying for help in the middle of the night, and there's people out there willing to help that are there. I mean, it should be a model for a lot of recovery. They've done, in my opinion, they're fantastic. And it's just an honor to be a small part of that group. I mean, I've had people join that couldn't quit drinking on their own, and this group has definitely helped them to do that. They've got a lot of successes out there. A lot of time we don't hear about the successes. And that's okay. That's not what we're here for. Solution. And it does my heart good to see that, happen. It's just a great blessing. It's a great bunch of people. I can't imagine having 70,000 people in a group and very, very little squabbling at all. I mean, everybody gets along well together. They're out there for the common goal of helping other people. And it's just phenomenal. We've been involved with a lot of suicide prevention out here. And a lot of it we see involves alcohol or other drugs. So that's kind of a motivator for us, too, with that many kids and grandkids. You know, we want to give them back a world that's a whole lot better than the one we had. And our world was a whole lot better than our parents' world was. But it's just kind of a natural thing, I think. But they are, they're people.
I agree. In the brief time that I've been part of the group, I've seen a lot of positive and love for each other in that group, and I found it amazing, absolutely amazing.
They are. And you can feel that, too. You know when it's sincere and when it's not. You know, if somebody's doing something for, like Wesley said a while ago, a pat on the back, you can tell that. And you don't see this with this group. They're just a bunch of people that came together and under Patrick's leadership, and they've excelled. I don't think I've ever seen a group excel as well as this one has. I encourage anybody that is having a problem with the substance abuse, try us out. Come on board if you're ready to. If you're ready to make a change, we're here to help. You know, that's the main thrust of this group. stepping up and helping each other out.
Mm-hmm.
They're really good at it too.
I noticed all the positivity and I do go every day and read because mm-hmm. I get that feeling of positive when I go into the group but I do a lot of reading and the reflecting as I do that and I didn't even know about the group at first but it's great. I think it's great.
Oh yeah, and I mean I went from at the height of my drink and I was working at night. I was a police officer and I would work night shift from 6 at night till 6 in the morning. And I would come home and start drinking. I would quit at least 8 hours before I went on shift. But the first thing I'd think of in the afternoon when I woke up was, how much alcohol have I got left? Do I need to stop by the liquor store on the way to work? And I went from that in the 80s, the 70s, to coming home and wondering if I got enough Pepsi for the day. I had been sober for quite a while before I came into this group, but still, every once in a while, the cravings were there. I don't think we ever completely leave. It gets far easier as you go, but I was just really blessed with the way my life came together. And I think part of that helps me to, when I'm talking to people, because I know where they're coming from. And I mentioned suicides. I was at one time when I ended that last toxic relationship, I came very close to completing a suicide myself. And I think that's one reason why I work with the suicide groups, because I know how easy it is to get to that bottom spot. Well, you know, it's thank God I didn't, because now it's my life's amazing. I mean, we still have our ups and downs, but compared to my life 32 years ago, this is just incredible. We've covered a lot of ground. We've had a lot of good times coming here. I think part of it, too, is in a relationship, you get two people that refuse to give up on each other. And when the times get tough, and that's huge, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's just... this whole group, just sobriety is a hard thing to attain, but this is the helping hand coming out.
Yeah.
These guys are good at it. It's incredible. I would just love to see more people. The more people in, the better. You know, the more people we can help. I think all of us have been there, so, and that's a crucial part, too. You know, because we understand what it's like.
Right.
It's, pardon me. Yeah, it's, have you ever been out to our part of the country? New Mexico?
I have. Actually, I like it out there. I enjoy traveling to New Mexico and Arizona, and I've been to Colorado once or twice.
Cool. It's a neat area. We celebrate a lot of our culture here. We're so diverse. We have, of course, our First Nations people. We've got, I don't know how many tribes affiliations we have here. There's quite a few, predominantly Navajo and Ute. Plus we have the Hispanic culture, the Anglo culture. And it's just, we've got the archaeology in the area from the ancestral Pueblo people. So we draw a lot of people from other countries. There's a group in Cortez, a nonprofit called the Cortez Cultural Center. And every summer they do, I think it's 3 nights a week, they have Native American dancers perform to give people an idea of what powwow dance is about and that type of thing. And it's incredible to watch the changes in people. You know, they just... We got people coming out here looking for teepees. I mean, it's like, what? But they're not educated in that area.
Right.
it's just amazing to me. I just think what we're doing here, the blog, radio is just, that's another really component to this. Really appreciate all you're doing.
You're welcome.
The logo you've done. That logo is just phenomenal, too. Really, really
Thank
like
you.
That one.
It took a bit to
now
get
you,
that logo.
Do what now? I'm sorry.
I said it took a little bit to put that logo together, but thank you. I appreciate that.
Oh, it's appreciated. The more information we can get out, the better. I think the main thing that impresses me about Sober Indians is our members. They are such wonderful people, and just to have that, to know that helps there anytime you need it. If it's nothing else,
mm-hmm.
just talk to somebody or have somebody listen to you, you know?
Yeah.
It's phenomenal. Absolutely phenomenal. I don't know. I'm not taking up a whole lot of time tonight, am I? Mine was kind of
You're
a short story.
I'm enjoying listening to you talk. So.
Good. When I came out here, I was 15. My family moved to this area. And I was like the same people I was just talking about. The only thing I know about Native Americans was what I'd learned in sanitized history books and John Wayne movies. And I got out here and I started working the farms and ranches like every 15-year-old did out here. A lot of it was with Navajo and Ute people. And I got to know them, and that started, I was home. I mean, that's all there is to it. They were so good to me, but and they've been good to my wife, my kids. We've got extended family all over both reservations. And it's always amazed me. We'll go to a powwow, or we'll go to a gore dance, or we'll go to Ute to bear dance. These type of things, and it's always, it's just like a great big family gathering. It's like a family reunion. It's just
mm-hmm.
amazing. They're incredible people. And
mm-hmm.
we've been very, very blessed to be a part of that. I think I'm about out of stuff. Have you got any questions? Or?
Well, if you had someone that came up to you and they asked you, or they told you that they needed help, how would you approach that? How would you go about telling them this is what we do and this is how we can help you?
I'm very vocal. I'm not very shy when it comes to about talking about this type of subject. And I have actually sat down with people and said, you know what? Because a lot of people they don't want to go to AA meetings because they get seen. We're a small area population-wise. And it's like, you know what? I got a place you need to go check this out, you know? And give them the address and start talking about what we do in the group. But you have help there 24/7. There's always somebody online. And I've had several people like that. That's the way we approach it. You know, it's just like with suicide. It's a lot of people can't ask the question, are you contemplating completing a suicide? And if you can't answer, you find somebody like me that will ask them the question. And it works. Just like this group works. It's phenomenal. It's been a great blessing in my life.
I think
that's kind of my story. I'm
well,
sorry, kiddo.
Great story. It's fine. I was just saying that, you know, you have an amazing story to tell. And I could feel the positivity coming from you and that tenacity to help people. And the group has a lot of that, too.
Yeah, there's the people. I am so honored to be affiliated with the same people in this group that just, I stand in awe of every one of them. They're just incredible. But I think we've touched everything I've got. Unfortunately, I'm a little bit short on time but it's been a pleasure to talk to you tonight.
Well, it's been a pleasure talking to you, too. I did want to ask you one more question because I know you were talking about some of the conditions at some of the reservations out there, especially with the no running water. If anyone wanted to help with that in order to try to make that happen so there was running water, per se, who would they contact or where would they go to help?
The tribal headquarters in Winter Rock, Arizona. And they could probably contact the president's office down there. And I don't have that number in front of me. But President Nez and Vice President Lizer have been working on that with some of the COVID funds to try and get running water and electricity. We don't have those same homes. A lot of them don't have electricity. Now, President Clinton actually set up with Cellular One a program where people on that reservation could get a cell phone for, I think it was $1 a month. And so you had a cell phone, but you had to run out and either charge it in the car or fire up the generator to get it charged up. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it's still better than what we have, you know.
Right.
I mean, it's incredible to me because you look at a nation like this, it's the wealth we have as a nation, and we're sitting out there with an area that big without running water or power. I mean, we have 80-year-old Navajos that have to go draw water for stock every day, every other day, and haul it to them. And that, you know, the unemployment on Navajo Nation is about 50%, and they depend on the livestock. That's a survival mechanism for them. And we got some little old ladies out there that, I've always said, if I could do what they do one day in my life, what they do every day of their life, I'd probably think I was the toughest thing on 2 feet. But that's just part of life for them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the things we're trying to remedy is the lack of amenities. The same thing with the Hogan we built down here with Southwest. A lot of Navajo people move up here off the reservation for education or employment. And then you do a ceremony and meet a Hogan. And homes 150, 200 miles away, well, now they have a place where they can go and do the ceremony or a meeting or a birthday or a wedding or whatever that has a dirt floor hogan where nobody's going to bother them because a lot of the Navajo ceremonies go all night long. Trailer house, your neighbors aren't going to like you when you're drumming at 4 in the morning. You know, I mean, that's just natural. But now they have a place they can do that now. So it's just a classic thing. Yeah, pretty neat. But anyway, like I say, Winter Rock, Arizona, the President of Navajo Nation's office, you can pick up the phone number on Directory Assistance, I'm sure. Like I say, I apologize, I don't have it with me. But anyway, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. And I'll be listening to this next one.
Okay, it was an absolute pleasure talking to you, and thank you for joining us tonight. And you have a great evening.
You do the same. Thank you for doing this for us. We appreciate you
greatly.
You're
very welcome. You're very welcome.
We will talk to
you
soon. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
And bye-bye. Bye-bye to you. You heard it. The way to help with what we were discussing with the Rimrock, Arizona Reservation, look up the phone number for their tribal office there and see how you can donate to help them. Those of you that are having problems with addiction and needing help for recovery, we have Sober Indians, and they are on Facebook, and it is an amazing group of people. Go look them up. Go talk to somebody. But anyway, I'm going to end the show for now, and you guys have a great evening. And good night.